Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is the other thing I do. This week marks the third anniversary of Someone Else's Movie, and I wanted to do something special to mark the occasion. So my guest is Andrew Fung, a veteran improviser and actor who just won his second Canadian Screen Award for Best Performance by an Actor in a Featured Supporting Role in a Comedic Series for his performance as Kimchi on Kim's Convenience, where he occasionally co-stars with friend of the show, Paul Sun-Hyung Lee. Andrew wanted to talk about Best of the Best, the 1989 martial arts movie starring Eric Roberts and Philip Rhee as members of an elite squad of athletes brought back together for a taekwondo competition with South Korea. And the thing is, Andrew came so prepared and found so many other connections that we wound up discussing, well, virtually every American action franchise produced in the last 30-odd years, and a few others as well. And also Hitch. Just trust us, follow the flow, we'll get to the title you're waiting for. I guarantee it. This is Someone Else's Movie.
You know, you asked me, and you said, Andrew, I want you on the show. And I was like, yeah, I'll do it. And I just want to sit down and talk to you about movies.
Sure.
And then when you're like, pick a movie, I'm like, pick a movie? How do you pick a movie? And I just kind of sat in my hotel room for a little bit. And I was like, what do I pick? And I think there's like obvious ones you could pick. Like Back to the Future and like those ones. But I'm like, I tried to think of one that like really hits home. And Best of the Best is this film that I wrote when I wrote you. I'm like, Best of the Best. It's random. You might not know it. You're like, I know it. And I was like, I thought about it. And that movie to me, I watch that movie maybe 3 or 4 times a year.
Okay.
And sometimes I'll leave it on when I'm working. I'll watch it at night. And I try to get my wife to watch it. And that movie holds up. And it's the first movie that had a mix of martial arts, which when I saw it, I was 7 or 8. I was in love with. I was doing taekwondo, and I love martial arts movies. But it's the first martial arts movie that had like a moral code and like made me think of like narrative. And so from that time, I used that movie as like an example of like how I developed long form improvisation.
Okay.
And that's my background, like improv.
Because it is it occupies this weird space because it had sequels. It was,
yeah.
You know, it was a mixed martial arts movie that was right out of the Van Damme era, but it didn't have Van Damme in it. It had Eric Roberts.
Yeah.
And
which I tell people, they're like, Eric Roberts?
Yeah.
Right? And it had terrible sequels. It had 2, 3, and 4. And Best of the Best 2 tries to maintain some of the allure and the storytelling of part 1, but it tries to make it more Hollywood and becomes a Van Damme movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then 3 and 4 straight up become Van Damme Seagal movies, which is a disappointing thing because number one to me is not just a martial arts movie. It's a story of many individuals and the reasons why they are fighting in this tournament.
Yeah. It's funny. I couldn't catch up to it again. I haven't seen it in 30 years, but I remember it pretty vividly. It was one of those films that was the VHS revolution where you could get a movie funded based on the cast you had attached. You could sell it internationally and you could get a distributor. That's when I first saw it. I think I reviewed it for the Stars Video Magazine at the time.
Oh, wow.
And it's a team of 5 Olympic athletes who overcome their differences to go compete against the Koreans.
And Olympic athletes is very generous. Like, it is 5 misfits. So it's a sports movie at its core.
Right, but that's it. Like, it uses the formula and then just kind of bends it and kinks it into something.
And like, action-y. You know, so I'll try to keep this spoiler free for listeners because I think you can watch Best of the Best on YouTube. It's available.
Okay.
There's a bunch of bootlegs on it.
Yeah, DVDs out there.
DVDs out there.
It's on Apple. It's not available. It's weird. It doesn't stream anywhere in Canada, but it's everywhere in the US. So the rights have obviously lapsed.
And it's about 5 individuals, and there's an upcoming tournament between the U.S. and Korea, which I think is so timely. Yeah. Like, I think it's South Korea, but I think it's so timely, the storytelling. And each of these individuals has a purpose of why they're there, and they have to go through like this qualifying round. But the movie doesn't put emphasis on like there's a cheesy Glee reference, like, we got to make it to the state finals.
Right.
It's not really that. It's like, they get there, and they're coached by James Earl Jones. And if I tell someone James Earl Jones is in a movie, they're like, oh, Angela Jones in the movie? It's Sally Kirkland's in this movie.
Yeah.
And so you have
Louise Fletcher too, right?
Is she? Yes.
Plays Robert's mom in one scene?
Yes. In two scenes. Okay. Yeah. And they bring together this team, and so you see the team come together a bit. A little bit of elements of Cool Runnings in a way,
mm-hmm.
of them coming together. They don't quite get along. They have different styles of martial arts. But then it's revealed, and this is, to me, is at the core of the story. There's two things happening. Eric Roberts has been in, he was previously injured in a fight years ago.
Yeah.
And he shouldn't be there.
That's right. Bad shoulders.
Bad shoulder. Yeah. He's at two screws and a metal plate, and he's working at a car factory, and he says, "Mama, I feel like I can still fight." So there's an underdog story there. He's got the busted shoulder, fighting for his kid. His wife is dead. He wants to do it for her. And then on the other end, Philip Rhee, who is only ever known for these movies, and Philip Rhee is very big in the martial arts world, he plays Tommy Lee, and Tommy Lee goes into tournament. You think that Tommy's is there. He's the best martial artist on the team. In a lot of ways, you think he's the only guy that can fight.
Right.
And then it's revealed when they give everyone their opponents that Tommy Lee gets Dae-Han. And Dae-Han is the most feared fighter in the world. And Tommy has this flashback because Dae-Han killed his brother. In a tournament like this when he was little boy. And the coach at that time was James Earl Jones. And so then it becomes this whole story of, like, Tommy's fear. And then does he do it? Does he fight for his brother? Does he run away? And then James Earl Jones is put under the spotlight because he knew about this. And he puts Tommy in that position. I just think that, like, that's when, to me, it became more than a fighting movie. Because at that time, 87 to 93, every movie was Van Damme, Seagal, something bad happens, you gotta kill the bad guy.
Yeah, they killed his brother, now he kills them back.
That's right.
It's always so basic and so simple.
So simple. Seagal's, like, three movie run during that time is basically, Above the Law.
Yeah. It's his cousin, right? Above the Law that gets killed?
There's a great scene where he walks into his billiards bar and he's fighting off these dudes. And, like, to me, that's a classic Seagal scene. But this Best of Best didn't really have that. It was more like scenes about your, like, moral struggle, your personal struggle with, like, the martial arts. So the martial arts was, like, secondary.
Mm-hmm.
And there wasn't these bloody scenes with violence because the fighting was done in the ring. So there's rules around it. So it was a very moral movie to me. And So I'm known for Kim's Convenience.
Sure.
And I think the really interesting thing that ties into all this is, 3 years ago at the Edmonton Fringe Festival, I was touring a show, and I was touring a show called Kill Hard. And Kill Hard is an improvised action movie. We interview the audience on who your job.
Oh, I want to see this.
And we turn your life into an action movie on stage. All we know is what we get from you, the audience, and all we know is that the hero's name is John Stryker. That's all it is. And it's me and another guy, and all we play all the characters. But to prepare for it, we watched like 100 martial arts and action movies.
Right.
But Best of the Best, to me, exemplified the internal struggle because heroes aren't perfect. And Best of the Best taught me that. And heroes have motivations for what they do. And we had to apply that storytelling to Kill Hard. And so when I picked this movie and I think about my experience as an actor now at Kim's Convenience, it all goes back to Best of the Best in some odd way. But the movie, like, I think it holds up. I went back and rewatched it the other night.
Okay.
Because there's no references. Like, I find, like, movies when they have references to like technology or something happening in the world, you're kind of like locked into that. But this to me just holds up because those things happening can happen in any time, you know?
Yeah.
A person feeling like they haven't fulfilled their destiny in life. Someone dealing with the loss of a loved one, you know, stuff like that. I feel like it holds up, but yeah, it's at my core of, like, of who I am.
So how often do you revisit it? Is it something you keep around?
Yeah, 3 or 4 times a year. I have the DVD in my bedroom. I have that and Best of the Best 2, like, together on my DVD player in their bedroom. Like, it's very odd. It's those two and the film Hitch.
Okay.
And Hitch is so... My wife loves the film Hitch.
I was
going
to say, that doesn't line up in any
no,
way.
It doesn't line up to what my narrative
it
is.
It has my single favorite scene that Will Smith has ever done, which is that bizarre moment. And it's that thing... Oh, this is so stupid. That moment where He takes Eva Mendes to the island. To Ellis Island.
Yeah, yeah.
And shows her great-great-grandfather, yes. And she throws up and can't stand it. That amazing... he was the butcher. I thought it was an occupation. It's just so weird, and he plays it so beautifully. But it's such a...
That's a specific scene,
yeah, too. It's stuck in my head. It's like 10 years now. I think I still have the Blu-ray for that very reason. Someday, I'm just going to use it as a master class of how to subvert expectations in comedy.
Yeah, because it's a romantic comedy, and... He brings her there because he's Alex Hitchens, and he's supposed to be like the matchmaker. He's the best at it.
Yeah.
So he sets up this amazing date. They ride a Sea-Doo to Ellis Island. He pulls a favor with the security guard. So you think it's going to be this loving moment. You're right. And it just flips the switch. It could be one of Will Smith's best scenes.
Yeah. It's because he's so graceful and so slick, and then it just completely falls apart, and he loses it. And he just...
Yeah.
It's the only time I think we really see the character flounder, and he's... Yeah.
I guess it's like, if we're talking about Will Smith now, it's like, I enjoy that movie, but not in the same way I enjoy Best of the Best. Yeah,
how has he not made more of these?
To me, like, I look at, like, his track record, and I'm like, that movie stands out because it's one of the few times you see Will Smith... It looks like he's enjoying acting, whereas, like, if he's done, like, action movies, he knows they're big hits... and he's tried to go for the Oscar, you know, with certain films. Yeah. But I felt like, Hitch, I was always surprised there wasn't a sequel or he didn't do more like it. And he's had a renaissance on Instagram recently with, like, doing more and more videos and little bits to try to show up his son. So I hope he does return to that. And there was a rumor of their rebooting Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Okay, sure.
And so I said the only highlight to that was that you actually might get to see Will Smith in a likable character again.
It's been a while. He is a phenomenally charming person.
Yeah.
And to see him turn himself off and stuff like Suicide Squad is just, it's not fun. It's there's no joy to it.
I was disappointed that he did a Suicide Squad because I felt like Will Smith, if I go back and look at him from Bad Boys and Independence Day onward, in an odd way, I'm disappointed with his career because I felt like he could have made better decisions and better choices.
Yeah. I mean, those are some charismatic performances, too. Like, he's a fun 90s action guy.
I compare him in a lot of ways to The Rock. Yeah. Because The Rock and Will Smith transitioned out of roles that no one really gave them a shot of doing it. And they both kind of have the same mentality. They will out-hustle and out-work anyone. And they will tell us. And so, but I look at The Rock's career, and I think The Rock's done a really good mix of really fun roles and charming roles, and I could always enjoy a Rock movie. So when Will Smith took Suicide Squad, I was just disappointed because I'm like, oh, I didn't see him doing that.
Yeah.
I didn't see him kind of, I don't want to use the word selling out, but I didn't think that he would think that was an opportunity to, like, really showcase himself. And the movie's not very good.
Yeah, I think that's the other thing, too. If the film had been any better, we'd probably be more generous about him.
Yeah, and you're right. Like, when The Rock went to a Fast and Furious franchise, like, I think people rolled their eyes. But
oh, he's so good in this.
He's so good. And he's got a spinoff coming out with Jason Statham.
Are they actually going to do
that?
Yeah,
they're doing
that's fantastic.
Doing a spinoff with him and Statham.
It could just be The Prison Fight from 8. If it's just that for 2 hours, I would still watch that.
Those two are so charming.
Yeah.
And I've been a big fan of Jason for a long time because he knows who he is. He knows exactly who he is, and every now and then he'll surprise you. You know, and I think that's good. He lowers the expectations a bit, and he does something like, oh, that was really good.
Yeah, well, like Spy. Have you seen him in... Did you see Spy? You must have.
Spy. Where he is so good.
Yeah. Because he's like arguing with his entire career.
He's a parody of himself.
Yeah.
And I love that about him. I just love the idea... When he's explaining to Ms. Melissa McCarthy all the things he's done. There's that great scene where she checks into the hotel. And I love her. I think she's so great. And here's a scene where she becomes the straight man. And he becomes the comedy hammer, and he's going off with all these things he's done and been in.
I'm immune to 178 poisons. And how do I know that? Because I've had all of them in a poison eating contest.
His arm ripped off, and he ripped it back together, and it cuts to her. She's like, "That's not good." Like,
yeah.
He's great in the movie, and so those two together are charming, but they also bring it. Like, you go to a Rock movie because you're expecting really good action. And he always delivers, but then he throws in that charm, like Jumanji. Like,
yeah.
If months ago, before Jumanji came out, we could have polled people, and I think the majority of people would be like, "Yeah, it'll make money, but it'll be a flop. It'll be considered a flop."
Right.
That movie
was huge,
huge,
and it's the what do they call it? The four quadrant appeal, where there's something in it for literally everybody.
Everybody. And that casting was great. You know, having Kevin Hart in there and Jack Black in there. But yeah, I think The Rock has done a good job. But yeah, those two in a Furious movie, and which I went back and rewatched all the Fast and Furious movies recently. Yeah. I don't know why. I just, they were on Netflix, and I'm like, it's time I do it. It really does get better.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, they didn't even know what they had until the third or fourth one, I don't think.
I think the third one that was supposed to kill the series. The third one was supposed to end it because it was in Tokyo. And
I like Tokyo Drift. I will fight for it.
I will fight for it, Tokyo Drift.
It's the first one, really, that is interested in the driving. And that sounds dumb, but it turns the stunts into beautiful things.
Yeah. I think Justin Lin directed that one. His first one. And he had done... Better Luck Tomorrow. And so in a way, when I explain like the complexity of Fast and Furious, because I tell them that the third one takes place chronologically before eight.
It's almost impossible to explain.
You know, and they're like, what do you mean? And I'm like, well, let me break it down for you. Yeah. And I explained that Justin took this character that he made, that he knew from college, and put him in all these movies so you can connect all these movies together.
Yeah.
But Tokyo Drift was, you're right, it was beautiful, the driving sequences, and when he did four and five, he applied it to that. Now after five, then it kind of went away, because then it wasn't just like a hit movie, it became a blockbuster movie.
Okay.
And everyone tries to get their hand on things now, you know, and it becomes the Marvel of cars.
Sure.
You know, but I think going back to why we're talking today, well, best of the best, like,
well, it's funny, I was going to say, the Fast and Furious movies are the things I think about when I'm trying to figure out what the modern analog of Best of the Best is, because it's a group of people, multi-ethnic assortment of specialists who are also doing this thing. Like the purpose, the mission, the it's all kind of there, right?
Yeah, and a lot of interpersonal relationships. Like, they're not strangers. And as you go through a film, you realize, oh, there's complexities between the people. And I think that is for a young comedian, a young Andrew Fung, was so interesting. Yeah. And that's why I do love the Fast and Furious movies, because I'll tell people, I'm like, narratively, they're pretty wild. Like, there's a lot of, they bring back characters, they find ways to do it. In part eight, they bring back a character that was in part 5, 6, 7 that you didn't think was going to be there.
Yeah.
And they give Vin Diesel's character like a purpose in like life. And I was like, blown away. I was blown away by that.
And it's, you know, having spent 15 years with these characters now, or longer, Jesus, I think the first one was 2000 or 2002. 2001. Okay. So So 16, 17 years now with these characters, it's like, oh, they would have these relationships. Like, this stuff goes on forever with them. Even if most of the movies take place within a smaller window of time and then jump ahead. It's like, they've grown up. They've grown old. If you stay in the Brian world, then he's off having kids and living his life. It's really weird to look at these films and think these movies are based on emotional complex. Like, they're about family. They're about family and loyalty.
Yeah.
And it's to the point where 8 makes fun of it constantly.
Yeah, it's become a parody on itself, because he's always referencing family.
But it makes it his weakness.
Yeah, and I don't have friends. I have family, over and over again.
Yeah.
And you're right, because I watched that movie in theaters when I was like 16, 17, and I was driving a Honda Civic at the time. So I remember as soon as I got in the car driving home, oh, it's bad news. Like, you know, you're speeding home, and it puts me in a place. You know, I think that series has grown with a lot of people, which explains its power and explains why movie companies will keep putting money into it, because, you know, guys like me will keep watching it.
Sure. I mean, I still watch them. I'm really... Like, Tokyo Drift came out the year I learned to drive stick, finally. And it was nice. I relate to this on every level.
Yeah.
I was that idiot young kid, except I was in my 40s. 30s. Let's say 30s.
30s.
And it's hard. It's really hard. The car doesn't do what you want it to do.
No, not at all.
It's really frightening. The first time you realize, oh, I don't actually have to touch the brake to make the car stop or go. Yeah. That's not right. But the thing I was thinking about in terms of comparing Best of the Best and Fast and the Furious movies is that Fast and the Furious movies have almost made a virtue out of their actors not being the best at acting. Like, it isn't until Johnson and Statham show up that you get the sense of... And maybe, you know, like, Michelle Rodriguez can do it, but she does kind of revert to that devil face thing she does.
Yeah.
And Diesel, it uses his limitations. Walker, same. And then with the best of the best, you've got this weird imbalance of having Eric Roberts, who'd been nominated for an Oscar and was like wildly overqualified to be in an action movie. Mm-hmm. And he seems to kind of know it. Like he doubles down on acting when everybody else is going through the physical stuff.
Yeah. Like he's the one that clearly tries emotional sounds and emotional like faces and reactions.
Yeah.
So you see it like going back. I think if you pick the five, Virgil and Sonny are the lower end fighters. They're not good. They shouldn't be there. They're the throwaway characters. They have one emotion. That's it. You very rarely see them. You have Chris Penn.
Yeah.
Chris Penn in there, who in a lot of ways just plays himself. Yeah, like
he always did, right?
His
strength as an actor was just
like
sort of
the unloved brother, like the second best. Yeah. Like, and he kind of get it here.
The DeVito of twins.
Yeah, the DeVito of twins. Who's the other Bridges brother? The Bo Bridges of comedy?
Oh,
yeah.
Bo.
Bo Bridges. My good friend, I don't know you, Ryan Belville.
Oh, yeah.
Jason Belville and Ryan Belville are from Loose Moose Theater in Calgary. And Jason would always walk around saying that he was the Bo Bridges of comedy. He was always the other brother.
It's a good way to bring somebody up. The Bo Bridges of the comedy. Ladies and gentlemen.
But Eric, yeah, he clearly has, like, he's acting. He's acting it. He has a scene where he cries. Mm-hmm. He comes to the coach to say, you know, he need that time off for a reason.
Yeah, yeah.
And the line is, "What the hell is wrong with you?" And he's half crying, half mad. So you're right. No one else has quite the acting chops in the movie. Even a James Earl Jones, because James Earl Jones is acting isn't so much like the. I don't know. James has a different status about him.
Yeah, he's not trying for gravitas. He's just he's an authority figure, but he's also. Really relaxed especially compared to Eric Roberts, who's very, very serious in all their scenes together.
Yeah.
I remember this more than anything else. I remember the tension in various scenes based on Roberts.
Yeah.
Because he's a fascinating personality as an actor because, you know, he made a real splash in stuff like The Pope of Greenwich Village and Star 80, where he's playing these big, like, complex, complicated, broken characters. Mm-hmm. And then Runaway Train, where he's kind of almost like an action figure model of some sort, where he's just doing stuff physically, but it's a great performance. He's really compelling. And then he swerves into whatever it is that he would do for most of the 90s, which is take a lot of parts, do a lot of work. I just assume for whatever personal reasons he didn't want to pursue a Hollywood career or he was unable to, like to do big star stuff. And he's never not interesting, but he doesn't always fit.
Yeah, like, I don't know if you ever looked at his IMDb.
Oh, yeah.
But it's, like, it's ridiculous. Yeah, like, it's like so long.
Fired a shotgun into a box.
Yeah, like, so I looked, maybe in 2013, I signed on to do a movie, and I was like, oh, who do you think we'll get for this role? They're like, oh, I think we'll get Eric Roberts. And I'm like, cool. And they came to me a little while later, like, yeah, we passed on Eric. I'm like, why? He's like, because he's got, like, 20 movies in development. So there's no... Like, there's no, like, if you're going to pay up for someone, you kind of want a little bit of a name as well. Mm-hmm. And so, with 20 movies in development, we don't get much, you know, bump from it.
Right.
And so, yeah, it's huge. And I think for me, when I go back to this movie, and you're going back to the movies you're talking about, this was in a time where he was having a good run.
Yeah, yeah.
And so this was like an odd movie for him to step into, but one I will be happy he did because he like legitimized martial arts. Eric Roberts like you could bring acting and storytelling to a martial arts movie.
Yeah, you're right. Most of the other stuff on the landscape was just simple revenge. And there were always one person. It was never about a team.
Yeah.
And this takes all of that. I mean, I guess it's like the Karate Kid in that the martial arts is demonstrative. It's not.
Yeah.
It's competitive rather than life or death.
But with the Karate Kid, why this movie kicked the Karate Kid's butt was that I felt these dudes could fight.
Okay.
So I felt like Philip Ree and Eric Roberts, which surprised me, could actually fight. Whereas, like, I don't think there's anyone in the world. I don't think anyone watched the Karate Kid and thought, yo, Daniel LaRusso could actually fight. No one could. He's the worst one. He's the martial arts hero that I would say 98% of the population could be like, yeah, I could beat him up. I could fight him.
Yeah.
Is that
the appeal of the movie, do you think? Because he is, like everybody was saying, how, you know, it has to be a white kid learning from an Asian master.
Oh.
And he could take that knowledge and bring it to the West, or sort of to a contemporary Western audience in the 80s. But maybe that's it. Maybe it's just like, oh, I could do that. Like, it's that
simple. Yeah, that you see yourself in him, that you could do it. Yeah. And then if you could beat him, it's even better.
Yeah, it's an aspirational performance.
Have you seen the new Karate Kid trailers? The Cobra Kai ones on YouTube?
No, no.
So YouTube, and Jason Belville is writing for it.
Okay.
And it's a thing, and they released three trailers for it. And I went back last night and I watched all three, because I watched every one as they came out. But then I watched the third one. I was like, wait. So it's a story between Daniel LaRusso and Johnny as adults. And Johnny's reopening Cobra Kai dojos. And then when I watched the first one, it was pretty cool because it was just Daniel and Johnny coming together. I was like, cool. And then the second trailer was about Johnny and why he wants to open the Cobra Kai. And then I was like, wait, do I like this guy?
I thought he was a bad person. Yeah. I remember him not being a good person.
So then I watched the third trailer. And Daniel LaRusso makes a joke, because it's Daniel LaRusso, Johnny, and like some random dude. And then Johnny says, oh, and the random guy says, hey, is this the guy's ass you kicked? And Daniel's like, no. But I kicked him in the face. And I said right there, whoa, is Daniel the bad guy in this? Is Johnny this guy now trying to, like, years later, kind of right the wrong of the Cobra Kai, and make it better while Daniel has been riding this high that he won these tournaments?
If you're going to give someone a redemption arc, that's a really interesting place to start.
I'm trying to figure it out. And I think that if they have the guts to do that, I'm blown away.
Yeah.
Because How I Met Your Mother years ago, Barney...
I was going to say, because that's the kind of heel turn from an 80s kid actor that I was thinking of.
and Barney Stinson's character truly believed that Johnny was the hero of The Karate Kid, and that Daniel LaRusso was his bully.
And Neil Patrick Harris, child actor of the 80s, playing a monster.
So if we're talking about Karate Kid, like, I'm very interested to see what they do, because if they do it this way, it makes the show interesting, because then it's not just a rehash.
Yeah. Well, everything is coming back, right? Like, everything
Murphy from the 90s. Roseanne. Murphy
Brown. Just let these people. Let them retire. I mean, I know she's probably bored. Candace Bergen wants to work again.
Yeah.
And I'm saying this from the vantage point of having just seen the new Tomb Raider.
Yeah.
Where it's actually pretty good.
Well, the trailer looks great.
They found a way to do it. They basically, like, they told Alicia Vikander that she could play a person instead of an action figure. And she invests her character with, like, the fear of death.
It's cool. Do you feel like it's going to be able to break? Like, it's going to be able to, like, kind of hop into the mainstream?
I mean, maybe. It's certainly the plan. Like, they're marketing it as a huge movie that is a big action tentpole, and they clearly want to make more. They set up a whole mythology for it.
Yeah.
And I sat in the screening room and thought, oh, okay, Kristen Scott Thomas is in this. Okay, Derek Jacobi is in this.
Yeah.
How are these people just... Nick Frost has two scenes and he's delightful. And Hannah John Kamen from Killjoys is in it for one scene. And like, I want more of that.
Yeah.
There's the potential to make a series here, but it's all based on a Lara Croft who gets cut and bloodied and bruised and isn't just, you know, a bulletproof thing charging through the movie the way Jolie was. And no disrespect to Angelina Jolie. Yeah. That's what they wanted to do in the movie. But this one is about a human scared person doing adventures. And with that, they sort of reconnect to the Indiana Jones thing where, you know, he gets beat up and he fails a lot. He's like, she doesn't yet know how to be a superhero.
I think that's what they did with what I enjoyed with the Captain America series, because I felt like when you spend time humanizing your heroes, you're so much more, like Christian Bale in Batman, you know, in the third Batman, like he's got a cane.
That's right. He's got cartilage issues.
He's old, you know, and I felt like, that to me is missing from the new DC movies, you know. And I think what we come down to in this conversation is a lot of the same things. Like, if we humanize the characters, we show their flaws and we show their internal struggles, then us as an audience will connect.
Yeah.
Even with a Karate Kid, like, if a kid can see themselves in a Daniel LaRusso, then they're like, oh, I'm connected to this movie.
Yeah.
But the minute they become too larger than life. Michael Scott put it best in The Office. Michael Scott was in that episode where he's a telemarketer, and he was like, John McClane, Die Hard 1, just a regular guy. Part 2, regular guy. And then 3, 4, 5, he's no longer a regular guy.
Yeah, the fifth one, he's like immune to radiation poisoning.
They're in Chernobyl.
Yeah.
With his son.
And everybody's fine with it.
How?
I saw it and I couldn't tell you.
He jumped into a pool of water in Chernobyl. There cannot be a pool of water sitting in that land that isn't contaminated.
No, it's got to be bad for everybody.
It's got to be for
bad. Don't they drive there in like an hour and a half from Moscow, which I'm sure isn't right.
Oh, I'm sure that's not right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just remember I didn't understand his son. I couldn't understand that. And then the Chernobyl thing just to me was like, oh, you wasted an amazing opportunity. Because it wasn't even over the top good. Because, if Fast and the Furious gave us Chernobyl, I think that would be amazing. Right. Like Vin Diesel is driving through a reactor. Ludacris has to kickstart the reactor for some sort of explosion, which will send the car far enough for Vin Diesel to go.
I would, just for the visual of it popping out of that tower, it would be worth it.
Yeah. So they didn't even have fun with it. If you're going to give us something so ridiculous, at least have fun with it.
Yeah. But then with Roberts in Best of the Best, you do have him playing Hurt, right? Which is the appeal to John McClane was... Terry Gilliam said he cast Willis in 12 Monkeys because of the scene where he's picking glass out of his feet and he's crying instead of just powering through it.
Yeah.
And he said, that's like, I want my hero to be human. I want to believe that he can be suffering.
Yeah.
And still, like, the whole point of being a hero is that you push forward. And so, once, I think it was the fourth one where they made him basically indestructible and nothing can happen to him.
Well, Eric Roberts in Best of the Best, at one point, he hurts his shoulder. And spoiler alert, he hurts his shoulder in a fight. And I don't know what it's like to have hurt a shoulder or hurt a shoulder that's been surgically repaired. Mm-hmm. But there's a point where like the referee goes to touch it and he like winces in pain.
Yeah.
Just at even getting close. And he like, he doesn't walk.
That's right. It's anticipatory. He knows it's going to hurt.
He knows it's going to hurt. And he has to get back to the sideline. And this was always an interesting acting choice. And I understand it now as an actor and someone who understands pain now. Mm-hmm. He didn't stand up and walk over. He stood a bit and then, like, fell to the ground and crawled over. And now that I think about it, I'm like, he's in so much pain that his body's in shock. His body doesn't know how to get him over. Then Tommy Lee has to pump the shoulder and he's... Then the adrenaline kicks in. He wants to pump it and he doesn't want to stop fighting. And he says, I got 1 minute left. I can finish this match. They tape up his shoulder. So, yeah... I think if we're going to look at Eric Roberts as an amazing actor, go back to this movie that like, I think is just hidden. Like I don't think I've seen it. Like you don't see it talked about.
No, it's kind of fallen out. And the fact like that it was a franchise too.
People
haven't really discussed that either.
Well, Best of Best 2, I remember when Best of Best 2 came out, I was doing Taekwondo classes in Calgary and I was so excited that it was coming out and it didn't do a full theatrical run. And I was so sad because I got the newspaper. I was like, it's not playing. And I had found someone to take me. I'm like, Dad, it's not playing. And he's like, I don't know. And this is the time where like you just couldn't go online to figure it out. Like,
No, the kids, they don't know this. They don't know the pain of knowing something is out there and having no way to get to it.
There were movies that were out or things that happened that you couldn't go see.
Yeah.
And so then you had to wait that it maybe came out on VHS.
Right. Year later.
You didn't know. Yeah. And that's why I tell people now, like tell kids, I'm like, so Jumanji is playing in my hotel.
Right.
I was scrolling through. I'm like, Jumanji's in the hotel?
It's gonna be on airplanes by now, right?
Oh, I'm sure it is. Last week. But Jumanji came out December.
Yeah. Late December,
right around when Star Wars came out again.
Yeah.
And so.
After Star Wars.
So that's only 2 months.
Yeah.
Well, two and a bit.
Yeah. No, time has no meaning anymore.
No meaning anymore.
I've tried to explain this to my nieces, who the youngest one I think is she 9 or she's 10 this year? She's 11. Mm-hmm. And she's never had to like wait for a tape to rewind, let alone wait for a movie to come out on disc. It's like, no, they've always just been able to get whatever they want whenever they want.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, these were the dark times. It would take 10 months to a year for a movie to come out because they would play it out, they would roll it through.
Well, like I remember a movie theater near my house always had these billboards, like little like street signs, and it said it would always list the movies that was leaving. So as a kid, I'd be like, oh, that movie's leaving theater? Dad, can we go see that movie?
Yeah, you have to see it. Because
I want to see it again for a year.
Exactly.
Star Trek Generations was the one. Star Trek Generations, like, where they're taking it to the theater, I'm like, no, I gotta see it one more time. I saw a movie like 6 times in the theater, and so it really has changed. I always ask my wife this question, like, what's the one thing you miss about our childhood? And I'll always say video stores.
Yeah.
I will always say. And I was sitting in New York maybe 2 years ago. We were eating a slice of pizza. And there's this pizza parlor where maybe, like, you know, 10 feet of space was this little movie store. It was odd. And a guy working on a little desk, and it had like walls like what we're in right now, and it's just a lot of shelving. Really? And a kid ran in before his dad, and a kid ran up and was looking at the wall and like picked the movie out and gave it to the dad. And dad's like, okay, and gave it to the guy. And he rented a movie. And I
in a pizza parlor.
In a pizza parlor. And I carry that image with me because I have two little boys. I have a 4-year-old and a 1-year-old. And I'm sad that we will never have a Friday night where we go to the video store and commit to a movie.
Yeah.
Because with Netflix now, sometimes we'll be cruising through and I'll put on a thing. And like, we put on a, not Coco. It's another one that's like a Cinco de Mayo theme cartoon.
Oh, The Book of Life, that one?
No. It had Channing Tatum's in it. I can't remember. But it's a cartoon. Okay. And I put it on maybe like 5 minutes in. And I'm invested in it. I like it. My son's like, I could watch something else. And I was bummed because I'm like, you know, when I was a kid, you got something. This was it.
That's right.
Like, you couldn't. Because then your mom or dad would be like, I paid $2.95 to rent this.
Right.
You're watching it.
Plus, it's the only option.
It's the only option. So there was a little mini documentary on Alaskan Blockbusters. Because they still exist.
Okay.
And they were interviewing people who were in there. And the reason why Blockbusters in Alaska still exist is because high-speed internet.
I was going to say, it's got to be the infrastructure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're like, yeah, we have internet, but it's like, you can't stream a movie. So Blockbusters up there are crushing it.
It's good. Yeah. I mean, I worked in a video store in the mid-80s when I was in university.
Yeah.
And that was my film school more than actual film school.
Yeah.
We would work like the midnight shift in the summer, because there was a time when video stores were not only around, but they were open 24 hours in case people came in at 2 a.m.
Yeah.
And somebody always did. And we would watch like 3 or 4 movies. We ran a whole bunch. This was 88, 89. So we did watch a couple of, like, we had action movie triple features and stuff. Whatever was available, you just gorge on it.
Yeah.
And that's how the best of the best movies continued, because the 3 and 4 never made it to theaters.
No, not at all.
Maybe one grindhouse somewhere in L.A. Out of some kind of contractual obligation.
Yeah.
It's going to be playing in theaters, right? Sure it is. Give us, you know, here's 10% of the budget.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Those are not good movies.
No, they're not. 3 and 4 is so bad, because 3 and 4 try to become what? 3 and 4 never revealed the human struggle of the characters.
Yeah.
And so it went back to the formula of, like, I think in part 3...
One of them turned into like a straight up action movie with people shooting at each other.
Yeah, like he's got guns. Oh, 3 and 4 is guns.
Okay, yeah.
But 3, I think, loosely resembles Walking Tall with The Rock.
Okay.
And so I think Philip Reed goes to a small town where his family is or something, and there's a shady sheriff and possibly drugs or something happening, and he feels like he has to intervene, which is the premise to Walking Tall.
Sure. And most, you know, like half the Seagal movies are the same way. Like that was just a template thing, right?
Yeah.
Chuck Norris movies are always like that.
They're always like that.
Silent Rage.
And part 3 and 4 don't have Eric Roberts.
Right.
So I think once you lose the actor, then it becomes this action movie, because there's no morals to the story anymore.
Right.
And like through this conversation, I'm really looking back at Eric Roberts, and I'm like really thinking highly of him now.
Oh yeah.
Because you know, the last thing I can recall seeing him in was he played Eddie Falcone in Dark Knight.
That's right. Yeah. He's doing a lot of DTV stuff these days. Like, he's the voice of the cat in A Talking Cat, and it just sounds like he recorded the audio in his bathroom. It's just, you know, he's going where the money is or where the work is.
I wish, is Eric Roberts capable of a Van Damme turn right now, where Van Damme became ironic? Like,
I don't know that he would want to. Like, Van Damme, I'm not even sure Van Damme understood it when it happened in JCVD, right? Because he went straight back to generic bad guy and action movies.
In Expendables 2.
Expendables, yeah.
What was his name in Expendables 2? Jean Villain?
That's right.
He's the villain. Jean Villain?
I mean, you have to give somebody credit for that.
Yeah, Stallone.
Yeah.
Stallone. And FYI, if you're listening to this, Stallone is coming to Toronto for the Wealth Expo.
No, I saw that on the subway.
Why is his hand so large?
It's to see the muscles.
And so his session.
Hand muscles.
It's called the Wealth Expo. It's him and like Pitbull,
right?
Alex Rodriguez.
A bunch of people I don't know, but who apparently have high followings on social media.
And I'm like, so what is Stallone going to tell me? Like, his session is called Knockout Strategies, and I'm like, is he going to talk about Hard Rock Cafes? Like, what?
I assume, like, he has some kind of, I mean, because like Schwarzenegger, the two of them were really smart about investing.
They were.
And they got to do whatever they wanted because of that, because they could, you know, they didn't have to work for the money.
Yeah.
And in film, because they had real estate empires or whatever else. I just, I want somebody to ask him, and no one ever will. I will if I ever get the chance to meet him. It's like, yeah, if you're so powerful and successful, why haven't you made your Edgar Allan Poe movie that you've been talking about for 35 years?
Oh, okay.
Come on, dude. Make your money. Make your movie. Do it.
Remember the movie he made in the early 90s?
Quote the Raven. Sorry.
What was the one where he played Oscar?
Oh, God, yes.
Yes. I
saw that theatrically.
You saw that theatrically?
There was one laugh.
That would be so bad.
It was fascinating. I saw it with 500 people at a press screen, or like a preview screening, a Wednesday night screening, free tickets on the radio. Everybody goes, they invite the press. And there is one moment in the entire film where the audience laughed. And it's the, I can't even remember what it is. It's some joke about, it's Tim Curry taking this amazing pause.
Yeah.
When Stallone is supposed to, his character name, Mr. Provolone.
Yeah.
Automatically funny, right?
Yeah, yes. Don Provolone. Don
Provolone.
Yeah.
He produces something that's, or it's a briefcase or something that's supposed to be money, but there's not money in it.
Yes.
And Tim Curry takes this amazing pause and then says, "Yes, that is an awful lot of money, Mr. Provolone." And the whole room laughed, and it was the laugh of, thank Christ, there's something we can laugh
at. Well, thank God you have Tim Curry in the movie to save this.
Oh, God, that was atrocious.
Well, he did Rocky V, and then he tried to, like, he did Stop or Mom Will Shoot, Oscar, and then he said, then he realized, okay, this is going to work, and then he made Cliffhanger.
Right. And Demolition Man, too, right?
Demolition.
Like, those are in that same window, and Demolition Man is really good.
Demolition Man, I watched, so that's another movie now. Now we're opening the can of worms. I really enjoy that movie. I don't want to use ahead of its time, because I don't want to give Demolition Man that type of credit.
Well, it's got Dennis Leary in it doing his thing from MTV, so it's like exactly of its time.
Yeah,
it's perfectly of the moment.
Yeah,
but it's so not bad.
It's so not bad, and there's a bit with the three seashells.
Yep.
With Rob Schneider, and I always thought that was really funny because it's clearly them laughing at the future, and the future will somehow make this a thing. But I quite enjoyed that movie, Demolition Man. I also enjoy Judge Dredd, and he made Dredd around the same time, maybe a year later.
With Schneider again, right? Like, they just went to the next set, I think, together.
Oh, man.
I remember being strangely happy with that one, too. Mostly because Armand Desante got his face right. Like, remember this
thing
where they're supposed to, he's a secret clone or something?
Yes.
And it turns out that that's why Armand Desante has been doing this thing with his face from his mouth for the entire movie.
Yeah.
You gotta give people credit when they pull that stuff off.
Yeah, and Armand Desante, like, I don't think he gets the credit he deserves. Like, he had some very good performances, but he's not in the mainstream of North American cinema.
Yeah, he was like too dashing for, he was too good looking to be an American leading man.
Yeah.
So they kind of shoved him to the side. Isn't he, it's him in Mambo Kings, right? With
That's him. It's him. Yeah.
And that's like a perfect performance.
I think that's the one I go to. That's the one I go to where if I was a kid when I saw it, but like understanding it now, I'm like, in my mind, I'm like, why is that guy not?
Yeah.
He should be in everything. He's so good. But Stallone, Oscar was so bad.
Still bear the scars from that.
I can't believe you're saying that you saw that in a theater.
Oh,
I'm just like, I'm kind of sad. I'm like, oh, you have to. I think I saw that movie on Laserdisc. I remember at one point, you had to flip the Laserdisc over, right?
Yeah, you got an hour on a side at best.
Yeah. And so, but the quality was unreal.
Yeah, at the time, right?
Well, it was at the time it would have been VHS, Laserdisc, or VCD out of Asia.
Terrible.
But those are so terrible. Because, you know, like, it's the equivalent of, like, getting a bootleg DVD from Asia now.
Yeah.
Still the same. But Laserdisc, and I saw Oscar on Laserdisc. My dad was going through this phase of Laserdisc movies. I don't think we have anymore, but I'm always interested to see what people keep and why they keep them. Because I still have, I've purged my DVD and CD collection and Blu-ray collection, but I keep certain ones for those reasons, and I try to think, like, why do we keep what we keep?
Right. I keep everything.
You keep everything?
There's some stuff that I just won't. And we're surrounded by Blu-rays, DVDs, Laserdiscs, and there's a few videotapes in that chest there.
Yeah.
Just because I'm convinced that like, physical media is the one thing that will never go away. I mean, literally, physically, it's here in the room with me. If I, if the internet goes down or if I need something in a hurry, I can always just know that it's right here. And as long as there's power, I can play it.
Yeah.
I can watch it. And I'm also just compulsive enough to want things that I know I may never get again. And, you know, as we're seeing, as happened with Best of the Best in Canada, you can't find it.
No.
If you go looking for it. The DVD, I was checking this, the DVD is, there's used discs for sale on Amazon for like 100, you know, the fake asking price they do to figure out if there's a market for it. But you can buy it in the States for $10.
Yeah.
But if that just, that to me is a perfect example of, I can't run out to the store and buy it now if I need it. And it's not on iTunes, and it's not, I mean, it's on YouTube, it turns out, but there's no legitimate way of getting it in Canada.
Well, it's interesting because, like, I walk into a room like this, and we're in a, for the listeners, we're in a room right now, like a little studio space with, like, bookcases of DVDs and Blu-rays and Laserdiscs and VHSs. And so I walked in, there's appreciation because I collect sneakers.
Okay.
And so I have a place, like a room like this, about 400 pairs of sneakers all lined up, and I recently tried to go through and sell some, but it's hard because I'm like, oh, I can't get this shoe anymore. Or I remember I got the shoe for this reason. This summer, every time I came home to Calgary, I kept bringing home a pair of Steve Nash Air Max 90s. And my wife's like, why do you have like 8 pairs of this shoe?
So this is the same style?
Same shoe. And I'm like, yeah, because you can't buy it anymore. And it was only released in Canada in 2 stores. And I have 8 pairs of them. There's probably only 120 pairs released of this shoe in those 2 stores. I have 10% of the stock. whenever I see it come up, I always grab it because people kind of devalue it now. Like it's not Steve Nash is not in our mainstream of current sneaker culture.
Yeah.
And so I always grab it. So I think I like tangible things. And I recently grabbed, last year I bought a Polaroid camera. And I bought it because, my son, now that when we take a photo, he's like, I take the photo. He's like, can I pull it out? And it comes out and he likes to pull it out and he sits on the couch and looks at it. And then he looks up and says, Dad, it's coming.
Yeah. I remember that.
That's such a wonderful, something wonderful to teach a child. The idea of waiting for something.
Yeah.
Because I think that the world's going to give him everything immediately. But if you can teach someone a little patience, you know, the idea of just sitting and being yourself, being normal for like 10 minutes. And I'm not sure I wasn't sure it was helping or doing anything until we went to go see Trolls in the movie theater. Cineplex does a $2.99 family Saturday event. I love it. If you're listening, Cineplex, that's a glorious idea. But he had to sit through like 10 minutes of trailers, 15 minutes of trailers, and he sat through it, right? Then we went back a following week later. Have you seen Peter Rabbit?
No, not yet.
See Peter Rabbit?
Rad was telling me that it was so much smarter than he thought it was going
to
be.
Well, I was excited because Nico saw the trailer to Peter Rabbit. I was like, Dad, can we see Peter Rabbit? I'm like, I'd love to, man. You know, the fact that he's getting into like movies now, not just cartoons. So we sit for the trailer. We sit through the opening trivia. There's like 20 minutes and he's a champ. And then Peter Rabbit starts. And the first scene is Peter's trying to get into Mr. McGregor's yard. My son looks over to me. He's like, Dad, can we go? I'm scared. I'm like, why? What's going on? He's like, Mr. McGregor's going to eat Peter Rabbit. I can't watch. And I was like, no, he's fine. He's fine. He's like, no, Dad, can we go? So this idea of the instant world, because he thinks we just go to another movie theater. So we left the theater. He's like, what movie are we going to watch now? And I'm like, nope, this is it, man. That was your decision. We're going home now. To the credit of Cineplex, they gave us back our passes and 2 new passes because I think they thought something went wrong. Like it was their fault. And when I really should just blame it on my child.
Our film has traumatized my child.
Yeah.
I must leave now.
Yeah. But I'm trying to teach him those values. And Best of the Best is a movie. Like, I think of movies I need to show my child.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a movie I want to show him. You know, when he's 7 or 8 or 9, I do want to show it to him because I think it will, I hope it will inspire him narratively with stories. And I use the word narratively a lot because so much of my improv, what I think is successful with my work has been narrative. I always want my characters to have flaws. I always want them to have, like, purposes on stage. And I think sometimes, well, not oftentimes in improvisation, you watch something and it's funny, but you don't remember anything with it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I've had those experiences where there's an individual beat that gets a laugh, but yeah. It just blows past to the next thing.
And I work a lot with high school students with improv, and I always talk about what's the story you want to tell, you know, versus what's the joke you want to make. And I always say stories that are connected, that are relatable, can get gut laughs, whereas jokes can get giggles.
Right.
And so I always teach students to fight for the narrative. And so I hope my career can continue. Like on a show like Kim's Convenience, there's a narrative I think we're trying to do. And so I hope that, you know, especially with someone like Paul, you've had on the podcast, hope we continue to tell those stories.
Yeah. So is the third season happening? I mean, is it actually, has there been a renewal yet?
As of this date today, has not been. I was on CBC Radio yesterday, and it was like Gavin Crawford's new show, and we were talking about the pandas going to Calgary, and I said, oh, the zoo asked me to host that event, but I couldn't do it. And as I said it, and I looked at the audience, I said, because I am doing something which hasn't been announced. And I just stood back. So I always tell people, I have great faith in CBC, and I have faith in storytelling, and I think people will be really happy. But Paul, oh man, when I feel like this might become like a bromance on Paul, how much we love him. But whenever I talk to Paul, I'm like, yo man, how many times have you been asked today? He's like, 10 times. People ask me all the time, to the point where like, his wife told me the other day he can't go to No Frills anymore.
Yes, he told me that story.
He told
me that
story. He can't go. So,
actually, no, I think he told Kate that story.
Out of all,
they were over here for a Christmas party.
And, yeah,
like this is like the best thing about this show is that I've now built, like, because these conversations are bonding experiences.
Yeah,
like whether or not they're intended to be.
Yeah,
if it goes well, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah,
and Paul and I have become friends, like outside of work, which is so great.
Yeah.
And delightful. And I love that he has become this successful in spite of his own comfort level. Like, I'm actually okay with him being uncomfortable because it means people know who he is.
Well,
so but yeah, the No Frill story. I'm sorry.
Out of the cast, you know, Paul, Gene, Simu, Nicole, Andrea, I think that I look the most like the guy I play. I talk like him. I walk like him. I'm him. And so I share with Paul. Paul and I will talk. And I'm like, I can't go to Costco anymore.
Yeah.
Because it's like, it just, people come out and it's great.
It is, everyone's right? Because so it great. Means people are watching, but it also means that you give up a portion of yourself.
Yeah. And I'm the type of guy that like, I'm just so grateful for people watching my work. So I stop and talk to you. My son, my 4-year-old, is so over it. We're at a mall. Someone stops me, and Nico's like, grabs my dad, let's go. Like, he just wants to go to wherever we were going. And so it's this interesting time now where, like, you know, the public has really got onto the show, which is great. But I find it funny now when there are two of us together, it's just like, it's like next level.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, when Paul and I were together in Saskatoon, in Saskatoon of all places, we already stuck out because we're two Asian guys in Saskatoon during the Canadian Country Music Awards. Oh, so you don't know if we're a Canadian country duo. Oh, this is a great story. We get off the plane that we flew from Toronto to Saskatoon. Ron McLean's on our plane.
Okay.
Adrian Arsenault, like all the big CBC people. But Ron McLean gets off the plane, he's got a cowboy hat. I'm walking with Paul, and Paul says, I gotta say hi to Ron McLean. If I don't, I'll kick myself. I was like, hey, let's go say hi to Ron McLean. Hi, Mr. McLean. Nice to meet you. He looks at us like, who are these guys? And then and he's like, oh, I'm here for the Canadian Country Music Awards. And Paul says, us as well. Watching Ron McLean's gears is go, who are these guys? And then Paul says, yeah, we're presenting an award tonight. And then Ron McLean just looks at us again like, who are you? And I think in his head, he thought we were like, some sort of Canadian country duo.
Yeah.
This Asian duo of country that is taking the world by storm. And then he's like, what award? And Paul says, album of the year. He's just like, has no clue. He's done. He's just like, I got no clue you are. And then he asks us where we're staying. And we told him this. He's like, are you staying at the Castle Hotel, which is the nice hotel in Saskatoon? It's the nicest one. And we're like, oh, no, we're not. So that night at the Country Music Awards, after we presented, we walk off the stage. He stands up and says, "Now I know who you are." Right. Like, goes up and shakes Paul's hand and my hand. But it was very nice being Sassy Toon. But I love people's stories. It's great. But it's definitely changed like how I approach just going out to things.
Yeah. Sure, I have to.
I think it does, and I try to be very. I try to be very conscious of it. Like I try to make sure to always stop and talk to people, because I think that's important for me. It's important for them. I think it's important for our Canadian culture that we are able to embrace fans.
But you do have to start building time in, right? Like it's a thing that happens.
Like, you know, I had to go to Costco to get cake for my son's birthday. So I'm like, I got to be there at 10 a.m. I got to be there when they open. So I go in and out. If I go at 3 o'clock, I'm going to lose half an hour talking to people.
Yeah. It's the stuff that nobody thinks about, but that just comes with any kind of visibility. It's not even necessarily success, right? Because it can just be...
It's just visibility.
A connection to something.
Yeah, you're right. Visibility. And I think in Calgary, especially because I'm like a hometown kid, my career, people have seen my career evolve in Calgary from being an improviser to an MC to this national scale. A lot of people just want to share like stories of times they've come to my improv shows, or they say things like, "Oh, we saw you host the Calgary Stampede."
Well, that's nice, because they know you're more than one thing.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
As opposed to, "I have seen you in my house and I can't figure out where."
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Which is the standard TV face. I've done TV hits, and the next hour people will just sort of look at you sideways for 5 seconds.
Yeah.
And it passes immediately for me, because I'm not someone that they recognize. Yeah. They just vaguely recognize.
Yeah.
You guys are in their homes every week.
Yeah. We're in their homes every week.
13 weeks at a time.
13 weeks at a time. It's really nice. It's really quite nice. And I think, like the Canadian Screen Awards were this week, and just the idea of like, I'm in rooms with people that I look up to so much. And, I'm a student of comedy, like much like you're a student of film, mm-hmm. I'm a student of comedy. So I love watching and understanding why things are funny, why things work. And now when I'm in rooms with people that I respect, it just blows me away. It blows me away. Like, you know, Brent Butt, I introduced Brent Butt the other night, and he came out and he said, "Give a round of applause for Andrew Fung. What an MC." I just was like blown away by that. Because here's this guy, hardworking, you know, he's come up for nothing, created one of Canada's biggest sitcoms, yeah, and he's doing his thing. It blows me away that I get that opportunity. Or like I said earlier, to be in a nominated acting category with Dan Aykroyd, you know, was pretty like Ghostbusters and Paul. So have you and Paul nerded out about his proton packs?
Oh, yeah, I've seen them. Yeah. So I mean, that's not true. I've seen the videos. I haven't actually seen the machinery.
Kim's Convenience audition, I get brought in for the final callback audition, and I do my scene with Paul. And I think, you know, I like to say that I was different than any person they had auditioned for the kimchi, but I, as an improviser, I like to mess around sometimes. So I did it twice. I did it with Paul. I did it with Simu. But Paul especially, we had a little bit of fun. Mm-hmm. Afterwards, he comes and finds me in another room. He says, "Hey, man, who are you?" We meet up, adds me on Facebook. And that night, he finds this video that I posted maybe a year earlier of me and the proton pack I had built. Because one summer, I said, "Screw it. I want to do something that is so different." And I was like, "I've always wanted a proton pack. I am going to build one." So he's like, "Dude, what is this?" And I just wrote him back. I'm like, "Here's where I went. Here's the forums I went to. Here's what it cost me." And so...
So you started it.
I didn't start it. I think I enabled him. We enable each other because we're always like, treat yourself. We always say treat yourself to whatever we want. So there's a shoe I really wanted, and it was a dumb price. And Paul just wrote me, he's like, "Treat yourself. You got to get it." And we very much bond that way because we're like both these nerdy people. So much the fact that Back to the Future is reuniting in Calgary.
Yeah.
At the
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. I was blown away at the news. And so I pulled out my Nike Mag shoes, my jacket, and I say, "Paul, dude, they're reuniting. And you got to come." And he's like, "I'll try." I think a week later he was at the ACTRA Awards and he was bidding up a auction package for a trip to Fan Expo, and it bidding got to like $10,000, and his wife was like, "No, you're not bidding anymore." And so Paul was out, but then I wrote him like, "You know, a trip to Calgary is $500, right?" So Hopefully he gets to come out and hang out with me and Kyle Reed, and we get to see Back to the Future.
Yeah, that'd reunite. Be great.
That'd be great, you know. And I said earlier, like, that's a movie that, like, I thought about putting in, but it is quite easy. And I don't think, like, I think Back to the Future is pretty groundbreaking for a lot of young people, but in an odd way, not as much as Best of the Best.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's all about what you resonate with, right? What responds, what you respond to.
Yeah. And maybe even now, like, I think sometimes we behave in ways we don't even know, but just like this moment right now hit me. Did I connect to Best of the Best because there was an Asian lead?
Well, I mean, it's a reasonable question, right?
Philip Rhee, Asian lead, who had an accent, but he didn't have to do an accent. It was just his accent. But the story wasn't about him being Asian. Mm-hmm. Like, him being Asian was just his character. Like, that's just who he is. His brother was Asian, that was it. But it had nothing to do with the story.
So it's more about what he can do within the world of the film.
Yeah.
Without necessarily identifying.
I think so. And, he just, to me, was the best martial artist. He was the most human out of everybody, and they really created a character I could get behind. So maybe now I'm like thinking about it. I'm like, did I watch Best of the Best 100 times because I saw myself in him?
Yeah. And is there anything wrong with that? I mean, that's ideally, I would hope he would be happy to hear that. We're in this right now as a culture with the whole question of representation and diversity and inclusion writers. Coming out of Black Panther, my first response is how great it must be right now to be a kid of any gender, any race, because you can find someone. You can see yourself. I mean, I'm a white kid in the 70s and 80s. I'm seeing myself all the time.
Yeah.
Everything was pointed at me.
Yeah.
I'm Jewish, but that really didn't make a big deal.
Yeah.
And if we had Woody Allen movies for that.
Yeah.
But now, like, the Fast and the Furious films being aggressively diverse, which is fantastic, in a way that never calls attention to any of it. It's just there.
Yeah.
If you were Asian, if you were a black kid in the 80s, all you really had were action heroes and villains.
Yeah.
And, I'm sure that was part of it, whether it was conscious or not, just to be able to have someone who wasn't evil.
He wasn't evil. And, like, the Koreans were the bad guys, but they weren't even bad. Because the way the movie's put together, it's not necessarily good versus bad. It's just people versus people.
Yeah, it's a competition.
It's a competition.
Which is weird for, I mean, even in Karate Kid, the bad guys are bad.
Like,
the opposition is bad.
Yeah.
And this is really not about that. It's more about rivalry than anything. But we're in a place now where kids can just watch anything and find themselves, hopefully, like, 2 years from now it'll be even better, 10 years from now.
Yeah. Kids, yeah, and, like, you know, boys and girls can watch themselves now and see something up there. And that's really cool. And I think that's always a comment that strikes me really, really, really at heart with Kim's. Like, I get teachers messaging me saying, like, you know, like, we show our class and these kids see themselves in you. And that's really wild to me. Like, I'm really proud knowing that my sons will be able to watch television and see themselves. And I always say themselves isn't just like people who look like them. Because, like, for me, you know, maybe like Philip Rhee did look like me. But just like, I think when you see a variety of things up on screen, and so this idea of representation isn't just like, I think there's movements for more women representation, people of color, but also abilities and disabilities, Like seeing that. That's why I was always so bummed when Oscar Pistorius turned out to be such a terrible person. Because I'm like, oh man, finally there was somebody.
Yeah.
And it didn't work out.
No.
There's that great SNL Jason Sudeikis sketch where they were spoofing the Carnival Cruise Line that was stuck on the water for like a month.
Oh yeah.
And Jason's like, hey y'all, you remember the Blade Runner? Well, he's nope. Like So, you know, I'm so happy when we better represent ourselves as a society. And I hope going forward with films that we get to continue that. Because you're saying it's a really cool feeling. And what's the name of the gentleman in The Big Sick?
Kumail Nanjiani.
Yeah, he had a great quote the other day where he's like, you know, to all the fragile dudes who are like worried about, you know, who to look up to. When I watched movies as a kid, I did see myself in like white dudes.
Yeah.
So you can see yourself in people of color and in women, right?
Yeah. It's not that hard.
No,
it's not that hard to empathize. That's the thing that's so weird about all of this is the hostility being driven towards the idea of other people who aren't me having their own yeah. movies having their, like, not everything is for, not everything should be for everyone. Mm-hmm. And the idea that you need, I mean, okay, with Captain America, it kind of has to be a white guy.
Yeah.
That's the deal.
Yeah.
But that's from the 40s. And you can have more modern stuff. You can mm-hmm. have different interpretations. You can also just watch a movie about people who aren't you, and maybe you can understand some other story. Like, it's not, I watch documentaries all the time. I watch movies made by people I don't know about places I've never been. And that's great. What they're for.
That's what they're for.
Yeah.
I love documentaries on Detroit. Because, like, I don't live there. Mm-hmm. I would like to go there and see it. It's not my world. And I was always surprised when Idris Elba, there's so much backlash of him playing Bond.
Oh, Jesus, yeah.
And I was like, okay, so the complaint about the Bond movies is they become stale after the first one the new person does. They often kind of go down after that, and they hit a renaissance later.
Well, filmmakers get nervous. They go back to what worked before.
And so if you want new things and new storytelling, and you want things that are refreshing, then you need to put new people up. And I would challenge anyone to question Idris Elba's acting abilities.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And so I'm just so surprised on people who have, like, these strong opinions on why something shouldn't be changed.
Yeah. Like, my concern with Elba playing Bond is that by the time the conversation came around, it's like, well, he's in his 40s. He's going to get too old too fast.
Yeah.
Like, you're looking at a Roger Moore situation where, you know, and Moore was, like, it's a very different performance. Obviously, I don't think Elba would be as campy as Moore, but he got old, and they kept making the movies.
Moore got old.
Yeah, and it's really, it doesn't help anybody. It doesn't serve anyone.
This is so off topic, but who is your favorite Bond?
I honestly think I'm down with Craig. Like, I think there's an anger and a physicality to him that I just, like, the fact that, and maybe it's simply that the movies are smart enough now, like, we're sophisticated as an audience. Yeah, the movies are definitely better, but they're, like, in Skyfall, after he gets shot in the chest and he plays hurt and fights with his legs for the rest of the movie, that's amazing. Like, they're thinking about how this would happen. But I like Dalton a lot. And well, see, Connery's great.
That's what I'm going to say, Dalton.
Yeah.
Because I went back and rewatched Living Daylights and A View to a Kill.
License to Kill.
That's right.
With Benicio del Toro.
Yeah, the villain has killed his partner, killed his wife.
No, it's, and the partner. Felix later has been fed to sharks, but he isn't dead.
Yeah, right? He's not dead. The wife is dead.
Right.
And I thought Dalton did a really good job. I went back and rewatched Dalton's performances, and I don't think he got the fair shake.
Because he was a good Bond in bad movies. Like, because they were still making more movies.
Yeah. They're still making more movies. So I wonder what he could have done in a Brosnan movie. Because Brosnan had the better effects, the better timing. And it had been like 6 years between the two.
It's the longest gap, right?
It might be the longest gap.
The same gap between, like, is Brosnan isolated by like 12 years on either, 6 on either side or something? But he's the one who is separate.
Yeah, he's the one that separates it all. And so I find that, like, I feel for him because I think Dalton's a very good actor, and he didn't quite get the fair shake at all.
Yeah.
But now, we're talking about Bonds, and, like, you know, like, I jokingly said I'd love to see John Cho as a Bond.
Sure.
You're like, really? And I'm like, it'd be different. Like, I like when movies are you know, try things out to tell different stories, because that at the core is what you should be trying to do. And especially with the Bond franchise with so many films. And that's the fear of a Fast and the Furious. Like, I hope they don't get stuck telling the same story.
Right.
And they might be.
I think they need to go to space now. I mean, there's like Skylab or something. There's no other. They've done everything.
They have done everything.
They had a submarine fight.
They had, they always try to fight to make things bigger and badder. I don't know. I would take a Furious movie that was a little more down to earth.
Yeah. So like they did with the Bond film, like Free Your Eyes Only, where he's really just removed from most things and just has to work it. Because that was the big deal. Like after Moonraker, they contracted after they overreached. They pulled back.
Moonraker was a big reach, hey?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like a new society in space.
I mean, it is a reasonable sci-fi premise, but not for a Bond movie. I wonder, like, the only real objection that I've heard to Elba, the only one that made credible sense, it's still race-based, but it's the argument that James Bond is a code name that's passed down, and the agents, they get killed, and they just, the next guy is Bond.
Yeah.
And then they kind of punctured that in, I think it was in Skyfall or something, you see his birth certificate and it says James Bond or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
But the argument then has to be that it's always a white guy because James Bond has always been a white guy. That's the only in-universe explanation that doesn't sound like a knee-jerk racial defense, but it is also that thing where you've OCD'd this so many different ways that this is the only answer.
Or comedically, you could have a situation where MI6 is like in a room and it's like, all right, Bond is dead. Who do we got? And it's like, oh, hey, boss, like all the James Bonds? Like, yeah. Just a black guy left. It's like, what?
We're out of white Bonds.
There's no white Bonds. Yeah, we killed them all. Like, yeah, we had a rough couple years. And you go through all these Bonds that have just been killed in the field.
Yeah.
Okay, what's his Bond's qualifications? That he has amazing qualifications. Yeah, but he's black, right? It's like, yeah, but he's amazing at it. I think they could have a really fun time.
It's like a Mitchell and Webb sketch.
Oh, yeah. I like, you know, we've talked about this Cobra Kai and how, if we look at comedy, I like when you take a premise and you just look at it from a different angle, and you just point out the obvious. So that Tim Curry bit you're talking about is so subtle. It's subtle but so funny. He's like, he has one or two choices: one to say like, "Hey man, there's no money," or one to be like, or to go along with it, right?
Yeah, this huge cartoon expression.
Yeah, yeah. Tim Curry's underrated in the film Oscar.
No, he's underrated in everything.
Oh, he is underrated in everything.
Yeah.
And we look at someone like Tim Curry. It will be a shame when future generations don't get to have someone like him in work, because like his career is coming down to an end, and,
sure, yeah.
and he's getting much older now, and so I we talked about this earlier, like there's a fear that like we are glued to like a Netflix system,
mm-hmm.
where if Netflix doesn't carry that film, we won't get a chance to enjoy it.
Right, it disappears
because why would you? What's the view rate on a film like Oscar? Like, I imagine in the world...
Four a year. Yeah.
Four. It's viewed four times a year. But, like, it's a shame that certain
generally
people...
Generally on a dare,
On a dare, or, like, what the hell is this?
Yeah. This.
What is this? Or someone just loves that movie.
Yeah. Every movie ever made is somebody's favorite movie. That's the weirdest thing.
Oh, wow. I've never thought about that.
I mean, maybe it's the person who made it, but... It's just the way it works, right? Everybody hates one thing that nobody else hates. Everybody loves one thing nobody else loves. It must work out.
I made a movie in 2009 with my best friends, feature-length movie. There's five of us that made it. It's called Sketch. It premiered at the Calgary Film Festival, at Edmonton Film Festival. Sold out screenings. Didn't go further than that. Yeah. But we made a movie, and it was on YouTube up until like a month ago. We had put it up just to share it, and we'd all moved on in our careers. And one guy wrote and was like, "Hey, guys, we should take this movie down. It hasn't held up well." And we all just joke. We're like, yeah, we made it for like $1,000. Of course it hasn't. And then everyone agreed. And I wrote, I'm like, no, but it's it's our movie. Like, I love it. I love this movie. We made it. Yeah. I love it. They're like, Andrew, you have 30 DVD copies in your basement. I know that for a fact. Like, I've kept the box of DVDs. And I'm like, fine, guys. I have it. But yeah, that's interesting that every movie is someone's favorite movie.
Yeah, it's kind of the premise of the show in a weird way, like accidentally. I can always get somebody to say, oh, that's my favorite. It's like, all right, let's talk about it.
Well, Best of the Best, when it came out, I was like, I hope he's seen it. And so the fact that you have, you know, impresses me. I also was going to pitch another dumb one, but it doesn't connect me the same way, but it's a movie I've been trying to get for years. It's called The Perfect Weapon with Jeff Speakman.
Jeff Speakman.
Oh, man.
That's got to be out there somewhere.
Last time I looked, I couldn't find it on DVD.
It was released. I'm sure it was released, because I remember reading about some kind of special feature that they produced for it.
A special feature?
Just the one.
Just possibly. The one?
Yeah. No, I'm sure I'll find this for you. This is what I can do.
That's what you can do?
Yeah.
I find that like the era of the early 90s was the era where like everyone was trying to get in on like action movies. And you only need like $100,000, $200,000 to make an action movie.
Yeah, they didn't have to be glossy or good.
No. Like,
there was that real break between the Joel Silver production line or Jerry Bruckheimer movie and then everybody else.
Yeah. 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 There was top tier names, and then there was like direct to DVD stuff. And I a lot of these movies I would watch on satellite dish.
Oh yeah.
Because there's a lot of like niche channels back then that would like there was a home for these movies.
Mm-hmm.
There was these homes, and they would play trailers all day long for
cable
them.
Forever. Yeah.
Yeah.
And TBS ran segments like, can't remember how many Steven Seagal movies in a row, but it was a thing at one point.
Yeah.
TBS had a deal with Warner, and Warner was the, like the home of Seagal.
Yeah. Yeah, and then TBS would also show do 40 Nights of Bond, like 40 nights that's of right. James Bond. 40 days, 40 nights, James Bond. I was like, oh my God, that's a lot of Bond movies. But yeah, that's a movie I've always looked for, and I find that like I'll go through Netflix and I'll go through like streaming options, and I love looking for like I'll try to start with one old random movie and see where else I could spiral to. But you kind of always get stuck in these like new movies that like.
Well, they're always pushing them at you too. Like Netflix is always sort of favoring the algorithm, whatever it is, always seems ganked, so it'll favor the five latest things that they've just paid for or produced, or Netflix original this or that.
Well, they remade Kickboxer with Van Damme. They made it with Van Damme.
Oh, yeah. Speaking of which, that showed up the other day.
Oh, I thought
you might want it. Kickboxer Retaliation. He is in it.
This is the sequel.
I don't know which sequel it is. I think it's the sequel to the remake.
Yeah,
the
Kickboxer Vengeance. Okay. It's funny because I watched the trailer to this recently. And
it's got Mike Tyson in it.
Well, Mike Tyson also did Ip Man 3 with Donnie Yen.
He's in Ip Man 3?
Yeah. He plays a wealthy land like owner, like an investor, and he fights with Donnie Yen.
Does he still have the face tattoo?
Yeah. He's not I think so.
Because he's got it in this. I figured they covered it up with makeup just so you wouldn't. I guess if he's not playing an actor, really.
I don't know. I can't remember. But he has this great scene with Donnie Yen. When you do those type of movies with those stars, you kind of gotta give everyone their moment.
Right.
So you know, Mike Tyson comes up. He's like, "You're not as fast as me." And so they go back and forth in this fight scene. Ip Man one and two are spectacular movies.
Yeah,
spectacular.
I've only seen the first two. I didn't even know there was a third one.
There was a third one. It's on Netflix, and it. I was so disappointed because 1 and 2 had once again this narrative, this wonderful moral narrative between Ip Man and he. It's set in a historical time. Like they're trying to give it.
Yeah.
They're trying to make an unbelievable character believable in this correct timing of it. And so Ip Man 3, I just was like, oh, I think the words jump the shark. You jump the shark. And it's right. Like, oh, I don't believe this anymore. Mike Tyson shouldn't be here.
Yeah.
But there's a whole stream of movies that like you have to go to Chinatown again, and I'm happy that still is a thing because streaming hasn't quite filled that gap
yet. Yeah, well I guess it's part of the import thing. If you aren't selling your film globally, then Netflix won't touch it.
Yeah.
So there's this whole side of distribution that.
Well, Netflix is trying. I think I've noticed more and more Korean.
Yeah.
Things on
television,
Netflix.
Especially.
Yeah. Like, those are popular right now, so I feel like at some point they'll catch on. The world is just closing in, but there are still pockets of things. But, like, even on the way here, though, like, everything we know is changing. Like, Toys R Us is
filing I just heard, yeah.
filing for bankruptcy. And I'm like, what? My kid can't go to Toys R Us?
Yeah. It's...
I think what I appreciate more now as the world changes is I've come to appreciate film festivals more.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, in Calgary, we have the Calgary Underground Film Festival. And I assume there's many like that in Toronto.
There's something like, I think there's one a week on average here.
Oh, really?
The underground stuff, maybe five or six.
Well, I appreciate them now because if they don't exist, I don't know how I would find gems of movies now.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's why I've always said for filmmakers, like I'm always like, man, it must be so much harder because like now not only do you have to like have an idea, make a good movie. The places you could send it now are so unclear where you could bring it that I wouldn't know where to go because it feels like the game is changing every day. Every day there's a new thing to do it.
Jason Jones was telling me about The Detour being distinct. The challenge of his show, The Detour, is that it has to be distinct in a world of 700 scripted shows.
Mm-hmm.
And that's insanity. I mean, there are 600 some movies released in Toronto last year, which is also crazy because now with DCPs, you can rent a theater for 3 days and pull all your movie and it plays.
Yeah.
But can you get people to come and see it?
Yeah.
And if it's in a film festival, will people know which film festival it's in, where to find it? And it's all about personal marketing and aggressive social media.
Yeah.
And who has the time if you're trying to make a movie? Who has the time to build the exoskeleton around it that gets it into people's homes or into people's eyes.
Yeah. I have two stories here. One is a friend of mine worked at a very, very large DVD production company.
Okay.
And I was like, what are you marketing right now? He's like, Fire Tornado. And I was like, what is fire tornado? He's like, tornado of fire. And I'm like, that sounds like the worst movie ever. He's like, yeah, but you know what? That movie knows exactly who it's selling to. And I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, we know where we sell that movie. That movie is going to like middle America, right? Mm-hmm. And to regions that still buy DVDs. And I'm like, oh, I guess you're right. And I'm like, what else are you doing? He's like, I got a movie with Rob Gronkowski in it. I'm like, what's he do? He's like, he's in one scene. And I was like, so he's a star of the movie? Yeah. But we know exactly who we're selling that movie to.
The Ron Gronkowski base.
Yeah, yeah. When did you interview Jason Jones?
Oh, it was a phoner. We talked in December.
So I talked to him in September.
Yeah, because he was... I missed him by a week. I was at the Winona Earp panel.
So I was there for... They had just... We were there for Kim's, but, like, they had just... They were like, Andrew, you went to talking with Jason Jones? And I was like, okay, yeah, cool. They bring Jason Jones to me, and he's like, oh, who are you? And I was like, oh, I got a TV show in Canada. And I was telling him about it. He's like, oh, I haven't heard about it. Da-da-da. As we walked to the film festival, I probably... And, like... We had just did all the marketing on Kim's.
Right.
Like, it was huge. We had done the big event. We
kind of because it launched, it was on the air like 2 weeks before, right?
Yeah, 2 weeks earlier. And so we were big, and I walked through on the way to the venue. I probably got stopped six times. People were just like, I love the show, I love the show. We get to the venue, he's like, who the hell are you? Who are you? And I'm like, yeah, yeah. And then so we hit the red carpet. And then Calgary's my city, so everyone's like, Andrew, Andrew, Andrew. And he's like, who the hell are you? And I was like, oh man, like let's roll together. So I interviewed him for the interviewed him on a panel, and he made this joke because he kept trying to jump to the Daily Show or the Detour,
right.
And I'm like, no, go back that time really dark time, you know, the time where you like were broke. And he's like, why do you want to talk about it? I'm like, because like I could talk about your success, but I want to know when you were broke and what you did to not be broke, because that's the interesting thing.
Yeah.
Because, like, for aspiring filmmakers and writers and actors, yo, it's great that you hear someone being successful, but they want to hear about, like, what did you do to get out of the tough times?
Yeah.
And so I kept bringing him to that, and he's just, like, I think he was a bit uncomfortable. But then people in the crowd, like, were asking him questions about that.
Sure.
And the one question that always resonated with me was, he told me about some shows that didn't get picked up. And I'm like, hey, man. How many shows have you written that have been picked up but never made? And he's like, around 40. I'm like, you've written 40 shows that had interest and development deals around and never got made. There's people in the audience, if they write one show and it doesn't get made, they're done.
Yeah. Oh, and I know that feeling.
Right?
Just the, ugh.
You write one script. You write five. There's people in the room who've written 10 scripts and they think their career's done. They have 30 more. Before they even get anywhere, you know? And so it's a good reminder of how hard the work can be to get there. And so when we get like a DVD, like Kickboxer Retaliation, you know, man, the amount of effort, well, I don't know for this, but for other things that need to get made. Christopher Lambert? Wow.
Everybody's in it.
Christopher Lambert. I read a thing the other day where he paid his way to fly in and make Mortal Kombat because he was making the most money on it and he felt bad.
That's kind of sweet.
He flew, like, they wanted to do reshoots, but they were going to do it, like, in, like, a studio. And he's like, no, I want to do it properly. So he funded that. And so that always made me, like, you know, that makes me like him more.
Yeah. It's those stories like Clooney never taking a salary raise on ER because he felt he was making enough money.
Or what's the one recently where Susan Sarandon got, someone gave her part of their salary. She found out she was making a movie and the two men were making more money. And someone's like, I'll just give you mine to even it out. I read it the other day. It was really nice.
Yeah, somebody else. Oh, who was it? It was Chastain who was fighting for Octavia Spencer on something.
And said, you know, we want to make the same amount of money. That's really nice.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, we're talking about this inclusion writer. I think it's hard to quantify that right there. But that's kind of what we want it to be. Like, you want to share the roles, but you also want to share the financial terms. It's a project you go in on altogether.
Yeah, and we're at this place now where people can do the right thing and get a huge amount of press, which is fine. Mm-hmm. I guess it's how it should be until everybody does the right thing on the regular. But we are at a place where, yeah, it's still weird and different that people are standing up and saying this is wrong or this should change or this needs to be better. And we'll just, you know, we'll keep doing it until it's everybody's better until everybody is benefiting and we're at a place, and that's going to take forever.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm trying to tie this to best of the best somehow. It's not working. Well, we can be the best of the best. No, see, it doesn't work.
Well, I always go back to the best of the best and I look at like...
But it is about fighting together. It is about...
It is about fighting together, coming together as a team.
Yeah.
And I think more so like what best of the best will always inspire me is like... I've used the word morals a lot.
Mm.
But I think that's so important in our narrative as a society. What's our movie going to be? What's our storytelling going to be? And I think that like... I get asked a lot. I'm pretty positive in my career, and I always say I'm very thankful. And Paul will sometimes get mad, and Paul's like, just enjoy it. You've worked hard for it. But I think I am a product of my community. I'm a product of the people around me. You and I have never met until today.
Yeah.
But I count you as someone. I'm like, I imagine that guy. I imagine Norm's a fun supporter because he supports Paul. He supports the show.
Yeah.
He's a supporter, and I try to surround myself with people that are good. And I think in a lot of ways. That's why I haven't gotten much hate, because I just surround myself with just really nice people, and I try to be really good to others, and I think that's created some good karma in the world.
Yeah, well, I mean, I like your stuff because your stuff is easy to like. It's good, and it's you know,
thank you.
I love the show. I think, yeah. And I think you know, just in terms of representation and all of that stuff, it's doing good work. But it's a good show.
Yeah,
like, that's more important to me than
does
it properly convey anything? Is it entertaining? Can I care about the characters? And that's something that, that's something I apply to almost everything, or pretty much everything.
Yeah.
Because if I don't respond to it personally, it doesn't matter if it ticks the other boxes. It's, I have to care.
And that's
for me to like it, not for the world to like it.
Yeah.
For me.
And that's why Best of the Best has resonated with me for so long. And I think it formed me of like, I don't want to put too much on it, but it formed me of like who I am as a human and as a storyteller. You know, and so I hope in this digital world, we can continue to make those movies because they really do matter. They really do matter. And there's a, I play a, you do box office heroes? No, fantasy box office.
No, I know about it.
You know about it? Yeah. It's like fantasy sports, but with like box office movies.
Right.
I love it. I love it. Cause I love analytics, and I love looking at what movies make money. And what I've determined this year is if there's any time there's a movie with people of color and women, it's always undervalued, and it will always be the top earner that week.
Right.
So I always buy that movie.
Because it's an excuse for people to get out and go to the movies.
And to see themselves in what they do.
Yeah.
And so we look at Best of the Best, and like I see myself in that, and it's a good story, and Eric Roberts can act, and I had no hand in making it. But I feel like I have a hand in maintaining its legacy. Like, people won't know that movie. I was interviewing Boss Rutten many years ago, and I was like, "Yo, you know Best of the Best, the movie?" And he just looked at me with a disdain. I'm like, "That's the question I led with."
But that's what this is. Like, it's about being a champion for the thing that you love.
Yeah,
that's what film criticism is supposed to be.
Yeah,
and it's what film appreciation is just inherently. If you like the thing, you're going to tell people about the thing, and they're going to see the thing.
Yeah, exactly. Like the thing, I when I hosted the Screen Awards this week, I don't know if I told you about this bit, but I pitched the Academy this bit where they're like, "What do you want to do, Andrew?" I'm like, "I want to utilize Snake from Degrassi," and they were like, "What?" Yeah, I'm like Stefan Brogren, you know, executive producer from Degrassi. I want to use him in a bit, and I think they were surprised because I think they were expecting, "Oh, you want to use Eugene Levy, right, someone in a big TV show?" I'm like, "Nah, man, Snake," and so the bit was. I go out to the crowd and I say, "Oh, you know what? I'm not feeling it. Like, I'm halfway through the show. I'm losing my energy. I wish my favorite teacher was here from high school." And then all I hear is, "But I am here." And I look over and I'm like, "Snake, you came." And then the crowd cheered, right? And I think it's one of those things. Like, for me, I love that thing. I love that thing. And it informed who I am. And I even told him when I met him, I'm like, "You inspired a young generation of Canadian actors."
Sure.
I saw myself in a 6'2" white guy, right? And so you can see yourself in a lot of things. But what I loved about him was that he was like kind of the nerdy guy, and meeting him, like, so he's such a good dude, and so be able to do that. But we champion the things we love, and so I hope to continue that, and we pass it down to our kids. And you know, we look at someone like Paul from Kim's Convenience. That guy has clearly passed down what he loves to his kids. They're all rocking proton packs and lightsabers. Oh, man. That guy's such a nerd.
It's adorable.
But, that's, you know, we started this long conversation about films, but Best of the Best is kind of the movie that started it all for me, and is the first movie that made me think about storytelling. And I know it's odd to say that about a movie like Best of the Best, but it really did. And so I will forever hold that in my heart.
That's wonderful. And yeah. Now that we have covered literally every action franchise in the course of this conversation, which is wonderful,
yeah.
I was quietly checking this online, and yes, The Perfect Weapon is available on Blu-ray.
It is? On Blu-ray? On
Blu-ray, in a special edition from Olive Films, and we will find a way to get
it. Oh my God. That's amazing.
Speakman represent.
My thanks to Andrew Fung, who's going back to Calgary for a bit, but will hopefully be returning to Toronto pretty soon for the third season of Kim's Convenience, which I'm assuming is shooting this summer? The second season was just released on DVD on the E1 label, and you can also find it streaming on the CBC website. Season 1 is on Netflix right now. Go check it out, it's a great show. You can find Andrew on Twitter at Andrew Fung, all one word, and you can find Best of the Best on DVD from Sony Pictures Home Entertainment in the US. It's also available there on iTunes, Microsoft, Amazon Video, and Google Play. In Canada, not so much, but you can order the DVD from Amazon US, or just hold out for a Blu-ray. I mean, if they put The Perfect Weapon out, anything's possible. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. If you want to leave a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts or wherever, it would be greatly appreciated. Every little bit helps. It truly does. It's been 3 years of clawing ourselves up the charts, and sometimes we can sort of see the top. And that's all due to you. So thanks very much, and thanks for listening.